everybody, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Hooked on Hitchcock. I'm your host, Jonathan Moody, and I'm here with my co-host. What's your name, sir?
G. Larry Butler.
All right, G. Larry Butler. He's my co-host for, like, I guess the series of this, and then we'll get a guest every once in a while to kind of come in and just chat with us about Hitchcock. But I figured at least for the first two episodes, it'll just be us two. So to begin with, to kick it off, we're talking about the 1944, I think it was shot in 43, but like released in 44, film Lifeboat. Let's talk a little bit about that. Like, when you first, like, was this your first viewing of this film?
My second.
Second. You had seen it before.
I saw it years ago, but not with an analytical mind. I wasn't looking for things to, you know, notice, and I took notes this time. So the first time I just enjoyed it, you know, and I didn't know anything about anybody. I mean, I was barely an actor, and I didn't even think about, you know, studying, you know, actors or film shots or angles or, you know, director's motives or anything. So
exactly.
Now it's a different mindset.
I think this is my third time watching it, I want to say, because the first time I rented it at the public library, and this is a couple years ago, I was on a Hitchcock kick right at that time, a Hitch kick, you know, or kick cock, you know, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. Kick cock. But it was basically this, I was on this like binge, I was like binge watching a ton of his films, and I would get them at the library because the library, you know, you can rent stuff, you can check stuff out for free. And they had pretty much almost every one of his films, right? Mm-hmm. And so on DVD at least. So Lifeboat was on DVD, and I was like, I'll check this out. And I really liked, I thought I was going to hate it because I knew it took place all in one location. And I am one of those people that get very claustrophobic when I watch films about like just one location. And so I had this like theory in my head that this would be like the one Hitchcock film that I was not a fan of or something, you know? And it was the exact opposite. It's one of my favorite Hitchcock films. And on top of that, I have found one that I bought and I own, and it's like one of my least favorite. I may have to give it, it may have to be one of the Hooked on Hitchcock episodes so I can give it another try. It's called Under Capricorn, but not many people have seen it because it is not a very well-known Hitchcock film. I don't even know if you've heard of it.
I have not, no. That was a real education for me. I'm glad we're doing this because I only knew the, you know, like a handful of the most famous ones, but now we're going to get to know them all. So it's fantastic. So
yeah. So we're going to watch as many, if not all of them, if we can, you know, or whatever, like all the ones that I really want to like explore, the ones, at least for this first full year, I want to explore ones that nobody has ever, like nobody talks about that much. You don't really hear that many people discussing Lifeboat, you know. Though you should, because this is a really great
movie. I studied the evolution of the man, his methods, his madness.
I'm
on board with that.
So real quick, I'm going to read the synopsis of it so people can get a feeling of what it's about if they have not seen it. If they haven't seen it, I suggest go see it before you listen to this, because we're going to dive deep into what made this film like so great. So legendary filmmaker Alfred Hitchcock, North by Northwest, Psycho, Rope, directed this suspenseful World War II thriller, a remarkable story of human survival. After the ship is sunk in the Atlantic by Germans, eight people are stranded in a lifeboat, among them a glamorous journalist, a tough seaman, a nurse, and an injured sailor. Their problems are further compounded when they pick up a ninth passenger, the Nazi captain from the U-boat that torpedoed them. With a powerful interplay of suspense and emotion, this breathtaking classic is a microcosm of humanity, revealing the subtleties of man's strength and fatalities under extraordinary duress. The stellar cast features the great character actors Tallulah Bankhead, William Bendix, John Hodiak, Heather Angel, Hume Crone, Henry Cole, and Candidelli. Lifeboat received 3 Academy Award nominations for director Hitchcock, Best Writing, Original Story by John Steinbeck, and Cinematography, Black and White by Glenn McWilliams, which we'll get into the Academy Awards later, because let's just say this was not expected, you know.
This Lifeboat ran way over budget. It was over schedule, lost money at the box office, and was overlooked until fairly recently. Now people are taking another look at it, and they really appreciate it. So, you know, he would have enjoyed the appreciation he got from it.
Well, I own the Lifeboat Blu-ray, and it's by Kino Lorber. They're a really good distribution company that has put out like some, you know, famous movies and everything. Usually classics. They're very known for those. I have a few Kino Lorber movies. I need to get more because they definitely have a really good selection. But this definitely was one of the films that kind of deserves a good treatment. It's got behind the scenes documentary talking about the making of it. It has like a 20-minute version plus 2 commentaries by like historians. So if you want to check out Lifeboat, my suggestion would be buy it for like $15 or whatever it is on Amazon for the Lifeboat Blu-ray, because it is definitely worth it. It's probably one of my favorite Blu-rays that I own.
Okay. Sound advice.
And after watching it last night, it's still up there. Like, I mean, I thought maybe some of the feelings would fade, you know? Since I hadn't watched it in forever, you know, I thought maybe I would change my mind or my opinion. And no, it's just, I think it gets better with each viewing. So I can't wait to watch it next year or something and appreciate it some more.
You pick up nuances you missed the first time. Yeah, I noticed that too. I started looking for stuff, and I was struck by all the witty phrases, you know, and a lot of things. You know, what it is a distillation of the larger world. It's a microcosm of the greater world and all our frailties and our failures and our foibles. And so that's what I enjoyed about it. And the pace seemed a little bit compressed. That's the one thing I noticed right off the bat. It happens over a 3-day period, and you're compressed into 90 minutes. So, you know, involuntarily, he had to compress the action. And the way he did it, to avoid tedium, right? He didn't want to stretch it out into real time, of course. You couldn't have. But he started by selectively focusing on like pairs of people and their arguments and disagreements, you know, their suspicion of each other, and then their gradual acceptance and compassion with each other. And so then they take one pair, and then you go to another pair and another pair and different segments of the boat. So you weren't really claustrophobic as much. And so some of it was necessary to do to avoid tedium. And but I liked the way he selected the 2 members at a time and did it that way rather than the whole group. But there was another one on a train. This wasn't an Alfred Hitchcock movie, but I saw it the other night, where these 2 punks, one played by Martin Sheen and another guy, terrorized an entire train load of people. And that was, you know, full ensemble. But anyway, the drama makes a difference. And I think that's what really is important here. And it's a sociological, psychological study of morality, trust, loyalty, betrayal, suspicion, prejudice, all these things. And I think what I read was, it was the greatest performance by Tallulah Bankhead in her entire film career. She's only got 26 movies. And she hadn't been on screen in 10 years, mostly on stage. So I really enjoyed her performance. She was like the central character. And Hume Crone, it was a joy to see him in his second starring role, or co-starring role. Because, you know, he was such a big name later in his career. And he was really good in his character. And so, you know, I could go on and on about different actors. William Bendix, who I really enjoyed on TV. He played Gus, the guy who, I don't know if we can do spoilers on this or not, but he's the guy that has a serious leg injury. and they take care of. And so, but I really enjoy the dramatic opening scene. You probably did too, where you see the smokestack sinking and the debris in the water, then the body and the whole the baby bottle and the whole bit.
So here's a funny story here real quick. Alfred Hitchcock was trying to figure out how he would do his cameo, you know, how he normally has this cameo where he's whatever. And one of the suggestions that he had was that he would be floating in the sea. So I'm wondering if he was planning to be like the guy that, you kind of the body you see, you know, except you would just see the face and he's just floating. But he decided not to do that, probably smartly, because he didn't want to probably go in the water and you know what I mean, or whatever.
He was afraid he might drown.
But he had a great cameo where he was a he's in did you catch this? He was in the newspaper. So he was in the newspaper, and it was for a I think it was called Reduco or something, but it was
how to reduce Russo. He was losing weight at the time, and he pretended to espouse this is a fake product, and people kept writing to him saying, how can I get some of this? But you know, Jonathan, I missed that whole scene because I didn't read the article beforehand. I read it after I already passed. So I'd already seen the movie. I thought, damn, I should go back and try to, you know, try to focus on that. I guess because I rented it so I can see it any time within 30 days. I'll go back and look at it again. But Kovacs reading the newspaper, you know, the big brutish guy that takes over the whole boat for a while. But I missed it. I didn't see the significance of reading the paper, but that was very funny.
It was just kind of neat that they did that, because, I mean, they did have to figure out a way to do his cameo, you know, and everything. And, I mean, you know, like it just...
He does that in every picture. But more directors should do that.
You know, I actually prefer people like, I mean, if they want to do it, that's fine. Stan Lee did it in a way, but he would actually have lines in his movies. So in the Marvel movies, you know, my favorite being Captain America Civil War, Stan Lee is the delivery guy that's giving Tony Stark his package. And then he says, Tony Stank, is there a Tony Stank here? And one of the guys goes, yeah. Is Tony Stank, you know, and he goes, I'm gonna call you that from now on, or something like that. But see, like Stan Lee does that, where he does like little cameos in all the Marvel movies, and I feel like that was sort of a nod to Hitchcock, you know, and I thought always thought that was really sweet. However, you know, so I think in each of these movies that we watch, we should do a we should look for the hidden Hitchcock cameo.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, like where's Waldo, right?
It's like where's Waldo? Where's Hitchcock? Yeah, and those are always fun. And some he's in the most bizarre places, you know, or whatever, you know, and he never has any lines, you know.
Maybe some of the audience can let us know, can help us find him.
Yeah, definitely.
So, down the road. You know, one of my favorite lines is you remember when the bottle floats by and. He Kovacs smashes it with the oar, and because she's trying to get a picture of it, right? And she's some glorified photojournalist who only thinks of herself more than the victims of the catastrophe. He says, "Why don't you wait for a baby to float by and film that?" I thought, "Oh my God, great lines in this movie." there's several.
And then there's also there was the baby, who well, I don't think there was an actual baby on set. I hope not.
No.
But there's probably a doll or something, because they didn't, you know, because you don't ever actually see the child, like other than the wrapping of it or whatever. You can tell there's a child in there, but it looks like probably a doll or something. Yeah. But it was that scene, just tore me apart. That scene where they look over and they go, you know, where is she? You know, right? And they look over and they see that she had flung herself into the ocean and drowned herself.
Yeah, you know? And we're talking about the mother.
The mother.
Baby. She can't live with her grief. And, you know, she's in denial. But even before that, there's a delicious little scene between her and the Nazi captain. Like, she freaks out, right? And then she drops the baby. She faints when she finds out she's dead. And he catches it. And then she starts pounding on him. And then she takes the baby back. And then she faints again and wakes up and then realizes it's dead. And she can't. She goes, what did she do with my baby? I guess they threw it over the side, right?
It's kind of terrible. I mean, at least I would kept the kid. That way they could have given him a decent burial, you know, or whatever. But I guess they just didn't want a dead baby on the boat. I mean,
no.
I don't know. It's
I think in reality, they might have eaten it. And, you know, I know that sounds terrible, but some people do things like that. Like a couple weeks in and they don't have anything to eat. They're all dying. You know, who knows? They cannibalism. And that's one thing he didn't go into. Of course,
which I'm a little shocked at, because, you know, he's got a little bit of a dark sense of humor. So I wouldn't be surprised if Hitchcock had thought at some point, let's make a scene where they all eat each other, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's in the sequel I've never made. Okay. There's just so many different things like that. Little things you focus on. You know, first he saves the guy's leg. And then he dumps him over the side later, like a day later. So he's compassionate. We're talking about the Nazi.
Right.
And, you know, he's a surgeon in real life. And so he's compassionate, then he's callous, right? How do I get rid of this rambling wreck of a man who drank seawater and he's got dementia? So it irritates me. And he dumps him over. So, you know, it's just true fascist, right?
Right.
What bothers you, get rid of it. So
exactly.
There's just so many people. So many little things like that in the movie. I was like, God, this is great. And as compressed as it was, it's just the thing between the Connie, the central character played by Tallulah, and Kovac, and they secretly desire each other. And the only fake part in the whole scene, I thought, was when he says a line like, dying together is more personal than living together in a storm, and they kiss. I'm thinking, that's a little sudden. They hate each other, but I think it's because they secretly desired each other and they had sexual tension.
Exactly.
They finally resolved.
Well, it goes to that idea that, like, you can say, a lot of people say they hate each other, but really they like each other. They just want to, it's kind of like the childhood stuff. You know, when you were a kid, if some girl said, I don't like you, you stink, blah, 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 that really means that she likes you, which is very confusing because, I mean, as a guy, I never picked that shit up. You know, somebody would literally have to tell me they like or dislike me. Right. And then I'll.
Yeah, we're clueless as males about stuff like that.
Yeah. So there's a great story that I read about, and there's this book that I own. Called The Dark Side of Hitchcock, or The Dark Side of Genius, The Life of Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh my God, that's a big book.
What?
That's a big book.
It is a big book. Darkness. Well, they go into a lot of his stories. So I'm going to read you some of, Lifeboat. The difficulties of realizing a script for Lifeboat were considerable. John Steinbeck, who thought that Hitchcock's obsession with a single set inhibited the drama, left the project after sketching a few scenes in a prose summary. McKinley Cantor was then brought in, but Hitchcock was disappointed with him and asked McGowan to let him go. Finally, Joe Swerling, who had crafted several scripts for other directors, worked on that screenplay until mid-July. Just before shooting began that month, Hitchcock, working alone at home, rewrote all the dialogue himself. He then asked Ben Hecht to read the script and then to make some suggestions after the final scene, as Hecht had done for Foreign Correspondence. So in a way, when I was watching some of the behind the scenes, it talked a little bit about how apparently this was sort of a sequel to Foreign Correspondent. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie or not, but at the end of Foreign Correspondent, there's a plane crash scene, right? And the people are in the middle of the ocean, you know, and have to get picked up and everything. So sort of like this goes very well with that movie, you know, and it takes place during the war, you know? So So basically, you know, Alfred Hitchcock wanted writers. He got finally got Joe Swerling to write it. But before then, they had like Ben Hecht write, or not before, after Ben Hecht wrote some, and Alfred Hitchcock changed all the dialogue. And I can kind of tell that, you know, it feels like a Hitchcock thing, you know. A lot of the lines are very, I don't know, very, you know, Hitchcocky, you know, like very, he's got a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek kind of attitude.
Yeah, sly and wry. That's
yeah.
True.
And there was some great lines in the movie. Trying to find, there might be some of the quotes that I remember. But there were, you know.
I wrote a couple down. Let's see if I can find them. Anyway, Hitchcock himself had a lot of neuroses. Did you know that he often fell asleep at parties because he was on opiates? Because he was so filled with anxiety to be around people. He was afraid of strangers. He was afraid of sex. He suffered from vertigo. And a lot of people don't know that. He enjoyed making people suffer, as we do know.
By the way, he's one of the only directors that could handle Tallulah Bankhead. A lot of directors did not enjoy working with her because she was so brash and she was so, you know, she was so bawdy. She was all these things that Hitchcock loved. You know,
yeah, according to Yung Croman criticized her. She talked too damn much. She never shut up. And then later he tried to make it nice with her by saying she was very professional and she knew her lines and she helped people even when she wasn't in the scene, you know, she'd read. And but anyway, that was pretty bad of him to say. She was high maintenance.
And she had this great thing in like there was a scene where I guess she was doing something or whatever, where people could actually like look up her dress and she wasn't wearing any underwear. And so it got back to the head of Fox, Darryl Zanuck, who told them all the way down the chain, to basically make sure she wears underwear. Right. So the unit production manager came up to Hitchcock and said, you know, Darryl Zanuck basically says if you don't get her to wear underwear, she can't, you know, the movie's gonna have to be shut down, right? And he looked over and said, I don't tell people, you know, I was like, I don't know what department that would be that I would have to tell. Would that be costume or would that be makeup? You know, right? And there's something like that. And I just thought that was hilarious, where he was giddy about everything. Like he didn't, you know, she didn't bother him whatsoever. And he could handle her.
He was a champion of stuff like that.
Well, he also sent her after like making her go through hell, which he actually gave her pneumonia, by the way.
Wow.
You know, she got pneumonia on this project. And after putting up with all that stuff, because I mean, we'll talk a little bit about this in a second, you know, about the stuff they had to go through in the movie. But he gave her a dog after that, you know, sent her a dog to have, and he named the dog Hitchcock after himself. But anyway, to go back to
the poor beast of hell.
Well, they did so much. To kind of like torture the actors, and it was just the only way they could do it, right? So nowadays, if you were to make a movie called Lifeboat, right, everything would be CGI, you know.
Yes, like, yes.
Rain, the water, all of that stuff would be CGI, because that would be the only way to do it without, like, you know, getting making people incredibly cold, or, you know, okay. What I mean.
Exactly.
So, but they didn't have that then. But they did have rear screen projection, so they could have it where it looked like they were out in the sea. They really weren't. They were in a studio. They were in a studio in a fake ship. So, I mean, there was no real actual danger, you know, like they weren't in the ship. They couldn't fall out of the ship, you know. However, there was like fake wind. There was fake water to, like, you know, buckets of water that would be sprayed out on them. And they would actually get wet, So it would get cold and everything. And on top of it, he did something that not many people can get away with, which is shooting wise, he shot from page one to page 100 and whatever, you know, on 100 or whatever it was. So he actually shot it in order, you know, all the scenes in order. And that's not usually, I mean, you're an actor, you know, it's usually not done. It's usually scenes are out of order, shot when they can to get people in and out, because shooting that meant that, like, if somebody wasn't in the scene in that specific time, you know, or whatever, that they would have to pay for that person, even though they're not in that scene. Right. You know, which, I mean, pretty much almost everybody was in that, you know, was in the scenes together, you know, or whatever, but
different ends of the boat. They would have to turn the camera and the lights around.
Yeah.
Know, and that takes time. But, I wanted to tell you something real quick. The guy that played Gus, William Bendix, he replaced another actor who got seasick. He worked 3 days and they dismissed him because he was sick all the time. I read the little tidbit.
Which is funny because he wasn't really at sea. Like, I don't
know. Well, they rocked the boat. No,
yeah.
It was actually being rocked.
Yeah, I get it.
So
it's just sort of funny because it, like, he literally wasn't really at sea, but it did feel like that.
It was almost his name, though. And then Gus lost his leg, remember? And he fell over the side and they brought him back. They were, he was minus a leg. And I thought, how did they do that? There's no CGI. So how did they cleverly hide it? I couldn't figure that out. This would be before CGI.
My favorite little part, though, is when they cut off his leg and they just kind of threw the shoe.
Yeah, I like that. They flew through the boot.
And the boot.
You know, that was a close-up on the boot.
Yeah, and I'm like...
Like that. And remember when the Nazi first gets in the boat, he climbs over, you see the hand come over and then grab hold of the side of the boat. I'm thinking, oh, Peter Lorre. And that one, the hand. Ah!
Peter Lorre would have been a great German... you know, but the problem with that is that everybody would have already saw him as a villain because that's all Peter Lorre played.
And he's not strong enough as an actor. I mean, he doesn't embody a strong captain type figure.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I was going to say he's a very strong actor, but.
No, he is, but he's kind of wimpy in a way. But,
that's
like a big bull. You know,
he was scary. Like,
he was very friendly. He looked friendly and he acted friendly, but he was cunning. Full of surprises. He hid everything. You know, he had a compass. He had extra water. He had pep pills. He had a lot of things. And it was a surprise. He knew English. That came as a surprise. And they're like, oh, you speak English? Oh, French too. Yeah, wow, Christ. So, you know.
So, I mean, and the reason he hid it, I think, is to you. I think he said a reason, but I think his real reason was so he could see what the people were saying about him when they thought that he could only speak German. So when he's speaking German and everything and people are saying something, he has to pretend like he has no idea what they're saying. I mean they did such a great job with that, because I had seen it twice other times and I forgot, like, you know, just kind of, it's almost like
I do that with Spanish. I pretend they don't speak it. And then, you know, they say something about it. Hey, you hablo español también. I'm like, whoa. Because we speak Spanish at home. So.
Yeah. Well, you want to, because you know people are going to say something else, you know, in their native tongue to each other.
And they do.
And they, you know, sometimes it's the, you know, something wrong, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So.
But this movie was full of surprises. So.
Definitely. And nice. Of the person, you know, of Hitchcock, who is known to be the master of suspense. It was very suspenseful, especially the ending. The ending of the film, we'll go into that real quick. Ending of the film is first of all, the last act, they have decided that this guy is no good. You know, he's lying about everything. He's, you know, kept things. He's killed the guy, Gus, right? Like
he let Gus die,
you know, drown in there. And that was brutal. That scene of him floating out and kept floating out. I was like, I don't know how they did that. you know, because there had to be somebody off, you know, screen, you know, be careful. Like, because I mean, there, once again, there's no CGI, you know, so they're really like, I feel like he was really out in the middle of the sea, you know, for those particular scenes, you know. Yeah. I mean, it was just, it was a scary scene. I mean, he could have, technically, he could have been eaten by a shark for real, you know.
Well, they were in a studio in a big pool. Like the same one mentioned, Rogers.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
A studio pool. They're over right. there at Sony. Where,
no, it looked like, it really looked like the, like, it looked like some parts were actually the, you know, the sea, you know. Like,
it was very authentic, yeah. So anyway, Hitchcock, one of his favorite phrases, he said, a burial at sea is simple, tidy, and not very incriminating. That's exactly what happened. He killed him that way.
Exactly. Oh, I forgot to tell you one of my favorite things he ever said, and this was on the set of Lifeboat. The other woman, the woman who played the nurse, she was an actor that had worked with what's his name?
Was she on God with the Wind?
She was in God with the Wind and a ton of other movies.
Mary Anderson.
And she was wondering, like, she would wonder a whole time about her looks, right? Like, you know, if I'm looking good, if I'm okay, blah, blah, blah. And so one day she says, you know, Mr. Hitchcock, what is my best side? And he said, you're sitting on it, my dear.
Oh, God, that is great.
I think I might have said that. I feel like I said that the last time or whatever, or I've at least told you that line. But yeah, it's one of my favorite lines because
I can't believe
he actually said that to an actress. You cannot say that now to somebody, you know, without it being a sexual harassment thing.
That's true.
Hitchcock would not be able, like literally Hitchcock would not be able to do half the shit. Now, then again, he wouldn't have to do half the shit that he did.
Right.
Because, you know, once again, like the birds, you know, he sicked real birds on Tippi Hedren and stuff. Well, that would be all CGI now. So she wouldn't have to really, she'd only have to act like she's getting attacked by birds.
You know, one of those ribbons almost put her eye out. I just read that. Tippi Hedren almost put her eye out. My God, what a son of a bitch.
But he didn't have the tools and technology that we do now, that I think nowadays he would be using those technologies, tools and everything. I would hope so, because if they would never let any director actually use real birds to attack, you know, someone.
No, the SAG would allow it. They have a safety officer.
Exactly.
Make sure of it. He also said, drama is life with the dull bits cut out. And that's exactly what this movie's about. You know, they compressed everything down. Like, it'd be tedious out there for several days, and you didn't get that, and you just got the bits of drama. But it didn't feel forced either. The pacing is okay.
Pacing was great. I mean, for an hour and 37-minute movie, it just kind of flew, you know. And which is great because, look, once again, I don't like being in one spot in one location for a whole movie because it just gets kind of boring and bland and I start to lose interest after maybe like 20-30 minutes because I'm one of those people myself. I don't write like that. Like, I don't like to write. I like to write with multiple locations and things going on to keep my interest. You know, when I write, I like to keep my own interest. When I direct them the same way. When I watch movies, I'm also the same way. I like to I have ADHD. I mean, like hell, you know? So I would love to just sit down and, you know, watch something that moves, and this movie moves at, you know, it definitely feels like it could have been a play a little bit.
Oh, easily. Yeah.
Except for the ending. The ending is so amazing. Let's talk about that real quick. And so the ending of the film, they have decided that they do not like that guy. That guy is scum. He's a villain. He's terrible. So they're going to get rid of him. So they all get together and in this really like suspenseful and just nasty like looking scene. You only see their backs. You don't see the guy, even. You don't even see him after a while. He just kind of disappears into the group, and then they push him off the boat, basically. But they need all of them to push him off the boat, you know, right. And everything. And so they push the guy off the boat, and he's, you know, sends him out to sea or whatever. And then they end up getting saved or what. Well, at first they're like, oh, there's a boat, you know, right, coming, you know, and they're like, oh, it's a Nazi ship, so at least we'll be safe, you know, prisoner, right, and everything. And then at the same time they think they're being saved by this boat, they notice that the boat is shooting at them. But it's not shooting at them. It's really shooting at another boat that's coming, you know, or whatever. And they're being attacked. And so there's this like tension between the ships and what's going to happen. And are these people going to make it, you know, even like you think, right. I mean, and in the world of Hitchcock, you don't know. They could have died end. I mean, everybody is expendable in the world of Hitchcock.
They're major plot twist at the end. So but even before that happens, didn't they fish with her bracelet? And she's lost everything. This is another thing that I love. First she loses her he throws her camera overboard, and then she loses her mink stole, and then her typewriter, then her suitcase, and then the bracelet. They bait for a fish, and then they throw the fish overboard because they see the Russian supply ship, the Nazi supply ship. And she loses everything. And then she starts laughing. Remember? The kind of the mad cackle, like when you lose everything and you just have a nervous breakdown.
Yeah. And you're just like, at this point, you're just like, you know, like your life is just, you know, there's just, I guess it's a very sort of, like, I was thinking about it, actually. It got me thinking while I was watching the scenes, because I was hearing her talk about all the stuff that she was losing, all the, you know, and I was like thinking, you know what? If I had a bracelet I really loved that meant a lot to me, you know, or whatever, but it went overboard in the ship, or somebody threw my camera away, I can always get another camera. I can always get another bracelet. I can always get another material possession, but I can't get my life back, you know? And so it would suck, and I would be very upset and everything. But at some point or another, there would come to this conclusion that, you know what, at least I'm still alive. I'm still on the boat. You know, like there's other people that have died, you know.
Well, you're a realist. Yeah. She was kind of she was so stuck on herself and her status because she was raised poor. And then she got elevated because of her bracelet. Somebody gave her a bracelet. That's a status symbol. So she's all about status symbols. And so when she loses all of that, she's got nothing left. All her props are gone. And so she was so dependent on that pretense that she was putting on that she finally cracked under the strain. But
exactly.
He says something like that. I can't remember what it was now, but it's just the whole situation. He said, can't remember what it was there, but he said there's a distinct difference between suspense and surprise. This is what I really love. Surprise is a big bang, which is unexpected and takes about 15 seconds to recover from. But it's suspense is knowing that there's going to be a big bang in about 15 minutes or so, and it's delicious misery and the anticipation of it being of you being powerless to stop it. You're trying to tell them, no, stop, don't do that. Whenever possible, inform the audience. He's telling filmmakers, whenever possible, inform the audience of impending doom, because that's kind of like what he likes to do, to keep them steeped in suspense. And then also, when the unexpected ending is in itself the highlight of the story, that's the only exception. So that was the unexpected. It was kind of the highlight of the story when, you know, everything got turned around and they almost got killed by friendly fire. And, you know, it was a big twist ending. So he did enjoy suspense quite a bit. But once in a while, I like to surprise you too. So there was a little of both.
Exactly.
But it's amazing. amazing. We did that photography, McWilliams or something. I wonder if they worked together before, because the camera angles were so interesting and they focused on things that you wouldn't normally pick up on your own, but they zoomed in on it. So it's like almost a reveal, you know, like, here it is, stupid. Look at this. That's almost too much. But I love that part of it.
I do too. And so the crazy thing is, I studied TV writing, right? And one of the things I learned was one of the things that you really need for TV, for essential, like, you want suspense, right? Right. One of the things you want to do is called ticking clock, you know, right? So it's like, you know, everybody's got, you know, it's like that bomb's going to go off and you've got 20 minutes to get there. But you, but the actor has to deal with like 15 minutes of traffic. Is he going to make it? Is he not going to make it?
Yeah.
There's that suspense of whether or not, you know, right? That's called ticking clock. But you need that in you know, any suspense kind of projects, you know?
Yeah.
And Hitchcock does that so freaking well of like, you know, you're waiting for these people and you know, like they have like a certain amount of time before, you know, things are gonna, whatever, right? You know, like,
yeah,
it works so well. And this movie is definitely one of those kind of projects that is, you know, for a movie where it's like nine people trapped on a, trapped on a boat, you know, lifeboat together, and they've got to figure out if they're gonna survive, you know, and then only but like five or six people actually make it by the end of it, maybe less, you know, like, and I thought Hume Crone was so good in this movie.
Oh, he is.
He's great in everything.
He did another one with Hitchcock before that one.
And that Shadow was the of a Doubt.
It was a career.
Shadow of Doubt, which
yes,
is Hitchcock's
favorite film.
Mm-hmm.
That's Hitchcock's
favorite film. Yep,
you know, I got to see that.
Now, I will say that's actually not true.
Oh, okay.
But I'll say this, because he has said, I think he said it to Truffaut, because Truffaut mentioned it, like, this has been known as your favorite film. And he was like, I don't know who said that. You know, who came up with that as saying that was my favorite film.
Okay.
It is, but it is basically it's one of his favorite films,
okay.
But he doesn't like to say favorite film, you know, and everything. And so I always get kind of mad, because like after hearing that he actually said that, like, I feel like it needs to be corrected that he's technically, it's one of his favorite films, but I don't think it's his favorite film. I don't think he really has a favorite film. He might be able to prove like his least favorite films, probably the ones that didn't do very well or whatever. But like, you know, you look at Psycho, you look at North by Northwest, you look at Rear Window, you look at The Birds, all these films are like perfect films. That's why we're not discussing because they're just talked about ad nauseum, and movies like Lifeboat haven't been. So
I prefer this myself, to start with the least known.
And then I mean we'll work up to other ones, you know, but you know, I have some fun ones to pick. You know,
there's so many aspects of this film that I enjoyed. I like the way that the central character, Connie, played by Tallulah Bank, had lost everything. But the group actually lost everything. At first, their food and their water, then their mass and their sense of direction, their respect for each other, and how they alternated between kind and cruel, and loyalty, betrayal, acceptance, rejection, suspicion, compassion, callousness, love, hate, the whole thing, the whole gamut is in there. It's like it's a slice of life, like how people really are. But it's compressed in this tiny time frame. And it just really rocked me. I couldn't get over it, because I'm a psych major. And so I was trying to study that. And we watched that the other movie, Suspicion. Well, this had suspicion in it as well. Did he or didn't he? Is he or isn't he? You know, that sort of thing. So,
and everybody's just sort of pointing the fingers at each other about stuff, you know. You know, especially
it's a disintegration of stability.
Well, right. You know, especially like... Going. Well, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is that the main guy, the main seaman guy, he wants to be the captain, right? Like he's Kovac. He wants to be the captain. And so he kind of tells them, you know, I'll be the captain. If you guys don't like it, you can just jump off the ship, you know, kind of thing. Right. Yeah. And they're like, all right, sure. Be the captain. We don't care. You know? Right. And then they're like, okay, which direction? And he goes, which direction did you say? I thought that was the funniest thing because, you know, here's this guy who's all confident about himself, but when it comes to actually like knowing what he's doing, he doesn't really.
Yeah. I won't go into detail, but politics in general, Mike makes right, but isn't very bright. And the first guy I liked a lot, he was logical. He had department heads and stuff, the Rittenhouse, you know, the guy that was the industrialist, because he was used to giving orders, but he was a nice, logical guy. I would have followed him. The other guy comes, he's just a brute and he doesn't know shit about anything. And mm-hmm. he starts giving orders and it's like, oh my God, you're an idiot. And then they all turn to the Nazi. It's like, because they found out he's a captain, he should know, but he's cunning and he gives them the wrong directions.
Yeah, so, not to Bermuda, which he told them, oh, I'm definitely bringing you to Bermuda because I'd rather be in a jail in Bermuda than be stuck on this lifeboat with you guys.
Yeah.
And that was the funniest thing in the world because he was giving them the wrong directions and they find that out toward the end, you know, which kind of sucks, you know, that they're.
Yeah. I actually believed them at first.
I did too.
And then I found out, oh, I'm being tricked. I'm being suckered in.
I mean,
because the guy's a Nazi. You know?
I mean, I would have been the same way as them, very trusting of this guy. But then at the end, when the other boat is sunk and that the other Nazi comes on board, you know, right? They are, you know, at first they're like, oh, let's take this guy in, you know, and they're like, have we learned our lesson from the last time, you know? And there, you know, there's that line at the end, you know, where it was, I think it's at the exact end where the guy's like, why, you know, why don't you kill me, you know, right? Or why wouldn't you kill me? And they're like, what, why wouldn't we kill him? Like, that's just, you know.
Oh, yeah. What was that line?
We weren't
a mob when we killed him. We were a mob when we sat around and let him take us, give us orders. That was someone who said that. That's when we were a mob, or a dumb mob.
He said, aren't you going to kill me? Aren't you going to kill me? What are you going to do with people like that? It's like, I don't know. I was thinking of Miss Higley and her baby and Gus. And then Connie, you know, Tallulah Blanket said, well, maybe they can answer for that. They can answer that, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yes, yeah.
That was like the last line of the movie. And it sort of really worked for it because, like, honestly, like, they trusted, you know, they trusted that guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That German guy, and he was just terrible. He's just awful person, you know, and everything. And you know, and this guy, this other German's asking him, aren't you gonna kill me? And they're like, you know, yes, you know, we should. I mean, they should, honestly, because he's just not to be trusted, you know. I mean, or whatever, you know what I mean?
Coming united, Here's something I read about Hitchcock. He wanted democracies, you know, several democracies all over the world, the Allies, to put differences aside temporarily. This is during the last days of World War II, to focus on the common enemy with spirit and determination. So that's what this thing was all about. Rittenhouse was a self-appointed captain, and he was removed from power, like we said, by somebody who wasn't so bright. But Hitchcock wanted people to focus on the fact that divide and conquer, you know, they're dividing us. So we need to unite together to conquer our common enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the point of the whole movie. And one thing I want to touch on is Canada Lee, one of the first Black actors to have a significant role in Hollywood at this time. And he inspired actually Sidney Poitier. And Hitchcock allowed him to write his own lines, believe it or not. And they said Hitchcock never did that, but he let him do it. And I thought he was really convincing, you know, when he said the Lord's Prayer or whatever it was, where they, you know, and they forgot what it was. And then he actually filled in the blanks and he quoted from the Bible. And, you know, he's a quiet guy, but he had dignity, you know, and he didn't play the step and fetch it role like a lot of blacks did back then. And so I was really impressed by that.
I mean, typically this kind of film, I'm surprised there's even the black character, you know, a black actor in there, because it just, you know, I feel like this movie wasn't like that kind of, you know, when it felt like that kind of project. And I'm glad he did it. I'm glad he put Canada Lee in there. I'm glad I did not know he let him write his own lines, but that totally makes sense. I mean, it's just, it's amazing because he did such a great job in the film, and really just, it was just remarkable, you know.
Yeah, he had quiet dignity. Didn't have a lot of screen time, but he had a presence. And you can say a lot about Hitchcock, his peccadilloes and his little evil ways, but that, you know, nobody's all bad or all good. So that was on the good side. You chalk one up for Hitchcock on that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, most people aren't, you know, I hate to say this is going to sound bad, but even Hitler, who at that particular time that they were fighting Hitler, I mean, I'm sure Hitler did nice things every once in a while, you know, like you can't, you know, not everybody is all bad, because the problem is if everybody was all bad all the time, then nobody would ever trust them. And nobody would ever, whatever, but you know, I'm glad.
Yeah. But what the bad that Hitler did outweighed the good by far.
Right.
So, we had everybody in that, people represented industrialists, socialists, fascists, socialites, poor mothers, oppressed African-Americans. It's a complete sociological, psychological study of morality, trust, loyalty, betrayal. That was amazing. So I recommend this highly to anybody who wants to see it. Just unbelievable. So, let's see, what else? I like the fact that people change towards each other often in this movie, just like they do in regular life. I already touched on that, but you never know what you're going to get from one scene to the other. They had some very clever close-ups by Glenn McWilliams. Look him up sometime. He's a DP. I don't know if they worked together before or not. They might have. Incredible in such a tiny space, and it did a lot of great shots.
Apparently John Steinbeck was not happy with the portrayal of Joe Spencer, aka Kennedy Lee.
I'm glad you touched on that.
Yeah,
so it's based on the story.
John Steinbeck said a neutered liberal was outraged by what he regarded as director Sir Alfred Hitchcock's racism, as manifested in his condescension towards Joe Spencer. Now, I mean, I don't know if he didn't know, like, you know, the what happened with the, you know, but that was the time period, you know, like the racism was just
embedded in the common morality.
Hell, it's even still today. It's very, there's, you know, if there was like one black guy and a bunch of like, you know, a bunch of white people, there'd be still some sort of racism happening on that ship today. You know, like
Well, I'm glad it didn't happen on that lifeboat, because
everybody, they're all helping each other out. And, you know, like there was nobody treating him worse than.
They did touch on that, because somebody called him George. He says, my name's Joe. Apparently, they called a lot of black people, especially at porters on trains and stuff, George.
Oh, that was
almost like the N-word.
Wow.
So, yeah, I read that later, and because I wondered why he said that. But he wanted him to know his real name. And so Steinbeck apparently clashed with Hitchcock over the screenplay. And he hated the movie so much, he wanted his name removed from it, even though he was nominated for an Academy Award. It's kind of embarrassing. He didn't win, but he wanted his name off the film. So.
Well, it's funny. The original director of photography, Arthur C. Miller, was replaced by Glenn McWilliams after the first 2 weeks of filming when Miller became ill. I'm wondering if he became ill too because of the seasickness.
Yes, with a rocket in a boat. Possibly.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't say why he became ill, but that's interesting.
So much about this film. I have to see it again.
Oh, yeah. It's a movie that deserves multiple viewings. And yeah. You should buy the Blu-ray at some point because, like I said, it's got like commentary tracks and other stuff if you're interested in like really finding out, diving deep. I mean, generally speaking, the commentary tracks by historians on these movies, they basically go as in-depth as they can talking about each scene, you know, and what Alfred Hitchcock went through, what the actors had to go through, all that stuff. Yeah. So they really dive into the stuff. And also I've got those books. There's a lot of them by, I think his name's Daniel Spato. Donald Spato. So Donald Spato does these books. As I said, The Dark Side of Genius. Then there's another book called Spellbound by Beauty. I think there's one more I have, and I don't have it down with me, but it seemed what I was kind of disappointed by was because all of them are written by the same guy, you know, a lot of them have the same stories, you know, and stuff. So it's not much different than the last book you get, you know, or whatever. Yeah. I was kind of interested because Spellbound by Beauty is mainly about the women who are in the Hitchcock movies.
Yeah, and stuff. Blondes, right?
Yeah, his blondes, or you know, sometimes he doesn't have blondes, you know, or whatever.
He liked the Nordic too, the Nordic race.
Yeah, so he but he mainly, so it's mainly about the women. So it talks a lot more about Tallulah Bankhead and how, you know, as you said, she didn't want to be, like, she wasn't very easily directed, you know, by people. So people, she wasn't in a lot of movies, you know, because not many people wanted to work with her.
Yeah.
But Alfred Hitchcock can work with anybody. In fact, people, just like many other directors, I feel like back in those days, there's William Wyler and a few other directors who have directed these amazing movies, right? Like, you know, just flat out amazing movies, but they're so difficult to work with. But still, actors are craving to come back to them because they know that if they act in one of their movies, they're going to get an Academy Award, you know, like, or something, or at least be nominated for one, you know, because Hitchcock was one of those people that was, you know, and this movie went up for a few Academy Awards and it didn't win, but probably mainly didn't win because of the fact that it was a what people thought was a pro-German story. People thought that he had the strong villain that was, you know, that was German or whatever. And at that time, they did not want to see the person get the upper hand of the people. You know, nowadays, a movie like this would shoot to the top of the, you know, shoot to the top of a list of people. People would put this at, you know, very high up. But back then, they didn't like it because they didn't like the guy actually outsmarting the Americans, you know, and everything. And understandably, in a way, because if you're dealing with, you know, it'd be like us dealing with the war right now, and then, you know, somebody from North Korea outsmarts us or whatever. Yeah, you know what I mean? Right. Like, nobody would want that. You know, nobody would want us to be outsmarted by it, unless it was like a dumb character and it was a comedy. Look at like The Interview with James Franco. Like, that's just silliness and fun. You know, that's one thing. But actually making a serious movie about it, nobody would want to see it. They'd want to see that the Americans are smarter than them from the very beginning, you know, and cunning and whatever.
Interesting perspective. I read somewhere that they treated him like a hero. One reviewer saying he was kind of in a hero position, or at least an anti-hero, because he was well prepared, you know, and he was trying to lead him to safety, to a boat that would take care of them, hopefully not kill them. they'd probably end up prisoners of war, but at least they'll be well fed and have comfortable cabins for a while and get out of the sun. And so, but it was kind of an interesting play on whether he was or wasn't. But anyway, I don't think he was, well, it's hard to say. He wasn't truly evil, but yes, he was, because he killed Gus. He did bomb their cargo ship. Of course, that was an act of war. You have to separate the warrior from the person. You know, are you following orders or are you just a malicious bastard? And so,
I mean, yeah, kind of Gus, killing Gus, like, I didn't understand that at all.
That was, you know,
that was just malicious.
Not necessary.
Yeah. I understand, you know, if Gus is, I think that the problem that they had was that Gus knew he was hoarding water and stuff and everything. Gus knew too much information, but like he could have, you know, if he had just had Gus survive and just kind of like told everybody, I'm sorry, you know, because at the end he did. He was like, look, I've had water. I've had all these things. You know, I'm trying to survive just like you all are trying to survive, you know, whatever. That would be one thing if Gus was still alive. They wouldn't have lynched him at that particular moment. But when they found out about it, that's when tables turned and he was like, they were like, we don't want this guy on our ship anymore. Like, you know, which is so funny because at the end they go, well, now you just lost us our motor, you know, like what are we going to do about?
Yeah, I know. It's like, oh shoot.
What are we going to do now?
We had any energy.
That's so funny. I guess that pretty much like sums most of it up, right? Was there anything that you, any of your notes?
Yeah,
that...
I don't have any more.
Yeah, I think.
Are you going to give it a?
What? Are we giving it a rating?
What rating would you give it?
Okay.
Are we doing that?
Did we do that the last time? I think we did. Let's do it. Let's do it from now on. From anyway. God, I never thought about that yet. I mean, I would give it a 4 out of 5, you know.
Oh, easily that, yeah. Yeah, I'll be with you on that. Yeah.
I can't wait to do like the lesser movies that, you know, like that aren't as great as this, you know. Like I would love to see, because there are some movies that he did that I just don't like necessarily. There's a few that I'm just either I'm too bored by it or I just wasn't, you know what I mean? It just doesn't hit me the same way. So, but this is definitely a 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. This is an adventure for me because I don't know too many Hitchcock movies other than the obvious 4 or 5 very famous ones. So this is quite a learning experience.
Good. I'm hoping the rest of them will be. I don't know. I was trying to look at my list. I had a list of movies that to do, you know, and everything, but I don't know which one I want to do next. I've got a bunch that we can do at any time. So I will kind of see what I want to do. I guess we had Suspicion and Lifeboat. Let's pick one together, okay?
Okay.
So, there's Dial In for Murder. There's Shadow of a Doubt.
I'd like to see that myself since we talked about it.
Okay. That's definitely up there. There's the 39 Steps, which we didn't do that for Criterion Watch yet. No. To Catch a Thief, The Lady Vanishes, Trouble with Harry, and The Lodger. Those are the ones I have for this you know, for this year. So do you want to do Shadow of a Doubt next?
Yeah, I don't know any of the other ones. I know the 39 Steps, but Shadow of a Doubt I'd like to see. I haven't seen and it kind of led to this, right? But he did that before this
one. I think he did Shadow of a Doubt before this one.
Yeah, that's what Hume Cronin was in. That was his very first movie.
Well, awesome. We'll have 2 Hume Cronin movies back to back. But that works for me.
They worked for another 60 years.
So, yeah. So, all right. And then let's plan for, what is it? Next in April, we'll do Dial In for Murder.
Okay. So. All right.
All right. So that's what we'll do next. So that's fun, dude. I'm excited about this. I think we're going to keep going. So people, if you want to catch up with us or anything, we just did Suspicion. So you can watch and listen to that episode. You've just listened to this episode. Next month, we're doing Shadow of a Doubt. And then the month after that, Dial In for Murder. And then so after that, we'll see what else we end up doing. There'll be 10 episodes. Was that?
I'm glad to be aboard. No pun intended.
Oh, no, that pun was intended. I can tell.
Pun was intended.
I don't like when people say pun wasn't intended, but there was definitely intention in that.
Okay, box. I admit it. I admit all that. All right. Pun was intended.
Exactly.
I'll start saying that now.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Larry. This has been such an fun podcast. I'm really looking forward to diving deep more into these episodes, these movies, and being able to, you know, talk more about Hitchcock, you know. So if there's something that we left out that you felt about about Lifeboat or something, just let us know what you think. Write a comment down below, or write to us at indiefilmcafe@gmail.com. Just let us know what you guys think. You know, were you guys happy with this? Is this one of your favorite Hitchcock films? Is this not one of your favorite Hitchcock films? Or do you not even like it? You know, some people might not like it. I don't know. I love it. You know, I thought it was great. And I can't wait to hear Shadow of a Doubt, like your feeling on that too, because that is one of the movies that just kind of shocked me too. It's kind of more like Suspicion as well. So, you know.
Oh, wonderful. I love Suspicion too. Yeah.
So there you go. Okay. Well, so thank you so much. Stick around so I can talk to you at the end. But everybody, thank you so much for listening. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. And join us next month when we do another Hooked on Hitchcock episode. Okay. Bye.
See you.